Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. On today's book review, I'm joined by Charmaine Lovegrove, co-founder of Dialogue Scouting. Up for discussion this week, we have A Notable Woman, The Romantic Journals of Jean Lucy Pratt, which gives an insight into the life of a British woman growing up in the 20th century. Jonathan Coe's latest satirical take on modern life in the novel Number 11, and an adaptation of Shakespeare's A Winter's Tale into a novel by Jeanette Winterson. That's all to come here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Charmaine. A Notable Woman is an abridged journal of British woman Jean Lucy Pratt, who kept a diary for 60 years, from 1925 onwards. It's edited by Simon Garfield. We're not delving into the life of someone famous or particularly remarkable here, but what does Pratt's writing offer us?
You know, the thing is about diary writing is that it just offers like a fascinating insight into the sort of everyday. And there's something about the ordinary that can quite quickly become sort of extraordinary when you're hearing about a time, a lifetime, which spans, especially when it spans a war, as her life did. You know, looking at Europe and looking at women and looking at the sort of the values of the society that we feel that we know about from fiction and films. But I think a diary offers like a very specific insight, and that's exactly what this book does.
So we meet Pratt for the first time when she's a 15-year-old girl in 1925. I mean, what sort of journey are we taken on from there?
So she has all of the normal kind of teenage angst, but then behind it, you know, she lost her mother when she was 13. Her mother was a concert pianist when she and she died when Pratt was 13 years old. So it's really young to lose a mother, lose a parent. So you're really kind of going through Jean's life, trying to sort of work out where she works out who she is with this huge absence. And her father remarries a woman called Ethel. And although Ethel is, you know, they really bond in other ways, she's never really so much a maternal figure. She's more of an aunt or a good friend. So Jean Lucy Pratt's really trying to work out life with a backdrop of European upheaval and trying to find a husband, feeling really fat. It's like a Bridget Jones of the 1920s.
It's interesting, you have this kind of this contrast between this incredibly intimate personal day-to-day experience and these enormous geopolitical events happening in the background. If we take something like the Second World War, what is her experience of the war?
Well, during the war, you know, she travels to Germany and she quickly comes back because of the tensions there. And she finds that ultimately, like, the war kind of interrupts her life. So she's now in her 20s, you know, she studies architecture, she wants to be a town planner, she wants to be a working woman. But actually what we find is that rather than it kind of really looking at just the political side of the war, you really see is this woman's urge to really be a successful woman within this world. And all of those plans are kind of scarfed by the fact that the war erupts, and, you know, and then all the men are gone, and she just feels as though she's just been left behind, and she doesn't really understand how or why that happened. In these 45 exercise books that she's written, you know, you really feel that there's this woman who really is yearning for great things, and that there's a lot of like regret and loss and sort of longing for a life that could have been. And I think that's something that we can all sort of empathize with.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned that she has a sort of, there's a sense of longing here. She always wanted to be a writer, or she wanted to be recognised as a writer. And there's something quite humbling about the fact that as the work goes on, Pratt increasingly hopes for posthumous publication. And now Garfield has now given her that, the editor. It's something quite moving about that, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Simon Garfield is an incredible writer and historian and sort of cultural commentator. And he always brings up the most interesting of topics. And whenever I see anything by him, I'll always take a look. And I think to have this kind of longing and yearning for a kind of more brilliant life, and then to be sort of thrust into the limelight like this, is something really, really special.
And it's quite a feat as well. You mentioned there's 45 exercise books and it takes up 60 years of diary entries. This is under 800 pages long, this book. How did Simon Garfield kind of tackle this task?
He is, as I said, really, really incredible. And I think that the idea that you would take on such a task and go through every single entry, and working with Canongate, who are such a respected publisher. And I think what he's really good at is basically like distilling meaning from a time that we don't really know about. And so I imagine that it was like really painstaking. I imagine that it was at times kind of boring, because, you know, she is also just a human being and there is like this ordinary element. But what he you brought out, I think, in this edit is the extraordinary.
A Notable Woman, The Romantic Journals of Jean Lucy Pratt, is edited by Simon Garfield and published by Canongate. It's available to buy now. Let's move on now to a new satirical novel by Jonathan Coe that reflects on all that is dispiriting about modern life in Britain. The book is called Number 11 and told through the eyes of Rachel, a 9-year-old girl when we first meet her in 2003. Charmaine, how does the story unfold from there?
Okay, so Jonathan Coe, this is his 11th book, hence it being called Number 11, and there's a lot of 11s in the book. And this is a kind of sequel, if you may, to What a Carve Up, which was a satire of Thatcher's Britain. And I'd say this book is a satire of Cameron's Britain. So what we're really looking at is Rachel, who is one of the offspring from the Winshaw family that we met in What a Carve Up. You know, it's 2003, as you said, weapons of mass destruction. David Kelly has just been found dead and at the height of the Iraq War. And Rachel basically thinks that the world is just too dark. So she takes a walk with her best friend and she discovers a dead body in the fields. And she thinks it's like a local tattoo artist that's is the murderer. Then we kind of skip to when Rachel's a bit older and she goes to Oxford, and then she's been at Oxford reading English, and then she's back in London and she's tutoring children that's super rich. So suddenly she's kind of thrust into this like super rich world, having come from a sort of semi-aristo world, but also seeing like the trials and tribulations of the everyday people. And really we're looking at anything from kind of, you know, free market capitalism all the way to like how social media works and the bullying that takes place online. And we're kind of looking at all of the things that allow our society to grow and burgeon, but with a totally bizarre satirical look.
Right. But when you say it's sort of bizarre satirical look, I mean, what's his style? Is it incredibly sardonic and dry the whole way through? I mean, how does he write this satiric?
Yeah, so it is really dry, but then really, you know, strange things happen. Like there's a man that like, turns into a spider and then kills Tories, for example. There's just like these really odd snippets of like comical elements that come through that only Jonathan Coe can really handle. And he's totally a master of that, of like taking the sort of sublime and the real and bringing them together to bring us something that's like totally original and absolutely of our time.
Right. I mean, it must be quite, I guess there's quite a contrast there, though, between this kind of very real world that he sets the novel in and these, yeah, slightly kind of bizarre, ridiculous elements as well.
And I think that, you know, ultimately the world that we're living in today is a little bit like that. You know, if you can be at a very serious desk job and then you'd sort of take a look at some things on Facebook and you're just like, what world are we in? And I think that's what he's saying, that we're full of sort of contradictions and we don't really know what's real life, and because there's so many different elements that are sort of thrust upon us. And I think he's asking questions about our culture and our values and our society. He's asking about the welfare state and he's questioning our politicians. And at the same time as questioning our politicians, he's also questioning us as subjects, really, within our state. And I think that those are really huge questions to us. But it's managed in a way that you can entirely grasp as a reader, because you don't feel threatened by it. But it does stay with you for a very long time.
I was going to say, actually, because a lot of people have said that this has kind of haunted them for days after they finished the book. And you mentioned that their sort of death around, you know, permeates the beginning. Did you have a similar reaction, kind of feeling a bit haunted by it?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of life imitating art at its very best. And I think that given our current political situation, it's really important that our writers are asking those questions. And we all love satire in this country. And, you know, we are also Guardian reading Pinot Grigio wankers. So it's definitely a mirror. And I think that's why it's haunting, because it's definitely a mirror of looking at our sort of liberal society and our place within it. And I think that all good writers should be doing that.
Number 11 by Jonathan Coe came out yesterday and is published by Viking. Charmaine, we're going to end today's book review with a retelling of Shakespeare's play The Winter's Tale. Jeanette Winterson has turned this classic into a novel called The Gap of Time as part of a series by publishing house Hogarth that aims to take Shakespeare's text from stage to page. First of all, do you think it's worth reimagining the works of Shakespeare like this? I mean, some purists might say we should all be reading the originals.
Of course, we should all be reading the originals, and that's why it's really great to have an education system that supports the arts so that we can all do that. But I also think that we can't always say that the relevance of Shakespeare is that his work, his writing, his stories lend themselves to a contemporary time without actually testing that. And that's what this series by Hogarth Shakespeare, which is also Viking in the UK, that's what this series does. I mean, Jeanette Winterson is just an incredible writer. We really admire her work in this country. And, you know, she brings A Winter's Tale into a time of sort of wealthy London and the Deep South in America. So rather than Cecilia and Bohemia, then it's sort of swapped with this sort of London mega rich. And our protagonist is like constantly trying to seek more from his family, his friends, and all of those around him, and eventually sort of pushes away his family, and there's lots of death and destruction. The daughter is then sent to America and is found in what Jeanette Winterson calls a baby hatch. Jeanette Winterson, I think, was a foundling, and so this story really resonates with her as being somebody that's found by a family, and rather than being put on the doorstep, then the baby is left in a baby hatch. So when you go to a hospital, you just see these hatches, and this guy just sees her there and he takes her and raises her. You know, it's such a magical world, the way that she's retold the story. And you can feel Shakespeare in there, in all the language, in the culture, in the imagination that Jeanette Winterson used. She really stays true to the original story. But you really feel as though that like dislocation between the rich and poor and right and wrong and all of that morality, it's very inclusive.
I mean, she clearly sets this in and sort of transports this into the modern day. You know, we have the financial crisis and all of that. What happens to the magic of A Winter's Tale? Because, you know, at the end of the play, Hermione is brought back from the dead and she turns from a statue into a real person. What happens to that kind of the magical elements in this story?
So you have our kind of contemporary Hermione, who is the mother of the daughter that's sent away, and she's sort of brought back to life. Actually, she was just living in Paris and was a singer in Paris, and then suddenly she appears on stage, but you think that she was dead. A lot of people are brought back to life, but it isn't sort of hammy in any way, and it actually feels like completely attuned with the story. And, you know, whereas Shakespeare then is very much like, yes, some turning into stone and then waking up, obviously you don't have that. It's that you're sent away and then you can get a plane and be brought back into the fold. But the morality of this tale of, you know, not crushing your opponents, not being so jealous, not considering yourself, not being so selfish, you know, those are the things that really, really stick out. And, you know, love, like, you know, Shakespeare, everything that he writes is always about love. And this story is filled with the emotion of love. And it does really show how timeless his work is.
The Gap of Time by Jeanette Winterson is out now, published by Hogarth Press. Well, I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Charmaine Lovegrove, thanks very much for joining us in the studio. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producer was Holly Fisher and my researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our film review with critic Tim Robey. But for now, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.